everyone, welcome to another episode of Infused with Light. Today I'm joined by John Henry, lead singer of my favourite metal band, Darkest Hour. They are a Washington, D.C. based band and have been around since 1995, which is showing our ages. They've toured all over the world, played countless festivals and played alongside some amazing artists like Machine Head, Killswitch Engage, Parkway Drive, Bring Me the Horizon, Hatebreed, Bleeding Through, and the list just goes on and on. I've been lucky enough to see them 3 times here in Sydney and survived each time. Today, to keep the conversation going in regards to music and mental health, but from a different perspective, I'd like to welcome John. So thank you so much for making time to chat with me today.
Thanks for having me, Jen. Happy to be here.
How are you holding up today with the news of Eddie Van Halen?
I'm going to be honest here. Like, I did not grow up a guitar player. I did not grow up a Van Halen fan. I got into music in the like grunge kind of era. So the 80s rock was something I didn't really grow to appreciate until later in life. But now that I'm like, but I realize that he's Mike's, our guitar player, favorite guitarist of all time.
Yeah.
I have been forced to listen to so much Van Halen throughout the years that it actually had this kind of opposite effect where, you know, sometimes if you're forced to listen to something a bunch, you get sick of it. But it actually started to grow on me over the years. And I was like, oh man, let's jam Unchained or something. And now I'm kind of like, I've been playing a lot more guitar lately. So I'm starting to really appreciate it later in life, which is, I think it's great when you can kind of discover amazing things like that. Music is the gift that keeps on giving, I guess. And there's like always something that you haven't discovered.
Sure is. So you guys have been pretty busy and proactive during this COVID time. So you've been busy with some assistance with some venues, and you guys have been involved with the Fender Play collaboration. Do you want to talk a little bit about what you've been doing?
Yeah, well, we just were able to do this. We did our first live streaming concert, and cat's out of the bag. It was a pre-recorded, you know, it was a live stream of a pre-recorded event. So that caused a little bit of confusion, but pretty much like the technology isn't where we want it to be able to deliver something that sounds as good as we want and that looks as good as we want actually live. So we, we were collaborating with The Black Cat, which is like our hometown favorite independent, totally independent venue that Mike and I both worked at for years. You know, we spent so much time there. So it was just a really huge part of our lives and our musical upbringing. So we wanted to kind of do something to help them out. And we reached out to them and set up a day where we got the band together, and we flew in a friend of mine from Los Angeles to do all the kind of directing. And we had a few camera people from DC, and, you know, we put on basically just got up there like a show, and we ran the whole set back to back 2 times, got a bunch of footage of it, recorded it. And then we had our friend mix the audio all together to get it, you know, really, cause we wanted to sound really good. We wanted it to look good. Yeah. It was really kind of a cool experience. It was weird because we're up on stage playing to nobody, but
to COVID.
But to be honest, we have done that before earlier in our career. So, you know, it was, practiced, you know, Darkest Hour played a show famously once to one person in Portland, Oregon, the first time we played there.
Lucky them.
But it was interesting, like being on the stage and like having the lights in my face and stuff. There were times where I would actually kind of forget that I was playing to nobody, and we would stop a song and I would be like, thank you. Oh, wait, who am I talking to?
No one to thank. Yeah.
cut that out of the audio, you know, but it felt great to just be on the stage again. You know, I think like a lot of things in life, you don't know what you got till it's gone. As the song goes, playing shows is something that I've been doing since I was 15 years old, and I'm in 1995. I'm 41 now. So this is the longest I've gone without playing an actual show. And it's tough. It's pretty crazy.
Yeah, especially when you live and breathe it. I mean, I guess we'll get into that in a little bit. But I also, with the Fender Play, how did that come into effect? I think that's been a really useful thing to help people keep mentally focused on something during this time, to shift their their mental focus, perhaps?
Well, we have been partnered with the Fender group for a while, where they own, I hope I'm not wrong here, but I'm pretty sure they own EVH, the, speaking of Eddie Van Halen, they own the amplifier brand EVH. So we've been sponsored by them for, we were actually the first artist to be sponsored by that amp company quite a while ago, and have maintained that sponsorship throughout the years. So we've always kind of had a relationship with them, and I can't take any credit for that. That's all Mike's doing. He's the one that partnered up with them and got stuff going with them. But that is really, really a great thing that they're doing to, you know, keep people keep people's minds occupied and their hands occupied.
Before we get into the mental health aspects, I have to ask this question, and I know you would have been asked this a bazillion times, but can you tell me what it was like growing up in Washington, D.C., surrounded by, like, such a phenomenal scene, like with Bad Brains, Minor Threat, because it's such a mecca.
It really is. I feel really lucky, really grateful to have, you know, that kind of, they're like, it's funny, we kind of had our own little scene going on like that. The original DC hardcore scene was before our time. So by the time Mike and I got into hardcore and going to hardcore shows, it was like the Earth Crisis era and Snapcase and Integrity, and that kind of like the beginning of what would become kind of metallic hardcore, metalcore, whatever you want to call it. So we were always kind of separated from that scene. We always kind of watched, or we always like were aware of it, and we loved those bands, but it wasn't actually as big of, I mean, I saw Fugazi a couple times, and to me that was kind of like, to me they're like the ultimate DC band of all time. Getting to see them was really life-changing, and it was, had a real impact on us, because they were so focused on this like ethical aspect. You know, they wanted, all their shows were only $5 so that everybody could afford to go to them, or they were free in the park. So, you know,
that's awesome.
They were kind of all about inclusivity way before anybody else was. And we learned a lot from that. So it was just a great kind of like guideline for us to start our career under.
Yeah. And good, you know, I guess role models in the sense with that inclusivity. So that's always a nice thing to have. All right. I've got a strange question maybe to start off with, but I was thinking about this today and I was like, you've literally been screaming for nearly 30 years of your life. Surely that takes a toll on your voice box. And I'm just wondering if you've ever had periods of where you've had laryngitis and or losing your voice, and does that impact your mental health? Because your voice, I'm assuming, would be a big part of your identity. So has that ever been an aspect or an issue for you?
It has. So for the first 15, I guess, of those almost 30 years or whatever, I had no clue what the fuck I was doing. So I was up there pushing, screaming as hard as I could, pushing as hard as I could. And I would kind of tear out my voice a lot. I was also partying way too much, like every night, and we can get into that also later. So I was not taking care of my voice. I would get I was always kind of prone to getting bronchitis, and I would kind of get to the point where I wasn't taking care of myself, and I would get sick, and then it would turn into a respiratory infection, then it would turn to bronchitis, and it was pretty it would be pretty miserable. Like I would basically, I've had to play, I don't know, maybe 10 or so shows where I had like no voice, and I was kind of just like whisper screaming, like kind of faking it. And it sucked. I probably should have just canceled, but we were such a workhorse back then, you know, and this was kind of in the early 2000s when we were touring, you know, sometimes 9 months out of the year. So like canceling shows was never really an option. I think the only time...
Yeah, no band likes to cancel, I guess, to be honest. I can imagine that's not something you ever want to do unless you absolutely have to.
No, actually, the only show I ever canceled was from the first time that I ever really experienced a panic attack. And that was in Reno, Nevada. And I woke up after a crazy party night and had this feeling that I was like, thought I was going to die. And I was shaking and was like dry heaving. And I was like, I got to go to the hospital, guys. That was the only time I had to cancel.
Yeah. And that would have, wow, we can talk about that. Definitely. I guess that would have been a massive reality check, I guess, just where you're at mentally and physically and emotionally.
Yeah. I pretty much pushed myself to, you know, like beyond the limit, and I got checked severely. It
takes a toll. Yeah. So, I mean, being in a band comes with a whole other dimension and perspective that in my other podcasts, we haven't been able to dive into. So you're able to give us that unique insight. And I guess I want to talk about how you manage mental health in two regards. The first one being like when you're touring, and then the second component of that being when you're recording, if you want to share any experiences that you've had during that.
I mean, the recording part is a lot easier, I got to say. The recording part, like mostly what I've learned from that is how not to interact with my friends and bandmates and to take a step back when you're clashing on something. And it's tough when you're putting all this, I think as far like for singers, especially, we're like really, I mean, every musician kind of exposes themselves, but, and this is not to like toot my own singer horn or whatever, but singers, I think, especially your voice is unique to yourself. And you're not only are you putting your voice out there, but you're also like putting these little poems that you write basically about like your feelings and stuff. So it's kind of like a double exposure there for your soul. And it can be tough. Like when you get, when you get criticism, it's very vulnerable. You're super vulnerable. And I think it took me a long time to kind of be comfortable with accepting criticism. And but the touring part is really the hard part. Like managing mental health on tour is something I just didn't do for the first, 20 plus years of our career. And it's something I still, struggle with sometimes. I think that when you're up there every night and you're playing in front of a decent crowd and I think especially with the, metal, punk, hardcore kind of genre, you're like literally hurling yourself into these people at times, screaming your guts out. People are screaming back.
It's so physical too.
It's so physical. It's so visceral. And there is this feeling when I get off the stage that I'm just like, oh shit, what do I do now? that was the most intense, amazing experience ever. What the hell am I going to do now?
I often think to myself, obviously not being in that position, but sometimes I wonder whether it's like a bit of a bipolar feeling, like such extreme highs. And then you just like, oh, like you just said, like, oh, okay, now I'm finished now. And now what do I do with myself?
It's exactly that. And even though I have had like MDD, major depressive disorder for my whole life, pretty much. So I've never actually I was wrongly diagnosed bipolar years and years ago, but I've realized like through my mental health journey that is not what I am, but it does, that kind of environment almost like breeds that in a sense, like what you're saying, because it's such intense highs. And then afterwards you're like, okay, what do I do now? And you look for ways to kind of like keep it going. And for me, a lot of times that was partying, and that was drinking a ton, doing drugs.
Yeah, another addiction, I guess, to seek it out, I guess.
Yeah, and clearly that doesn't really work. I think anytime you kind of try to fill a void in yourself with anything, whether it's drugs, alcohol, or sex or whatever, you're going to have problems. And it took me so long to realize that, like, I have to like basically change my whole personality around after a show.
And I think it's difficult for men. Something that's come up through my conversations and through doing these chats is that it's difficult. I mean, it's difficult for anyone to sit with their shit, but it seems a little bit more so for men to have that ability, I just feel like it seems a little bit more challenging for guys to just be like, I'm going to sit with this rather than that desire to escape into said, be it drugs, alcohol, whatever it is. So,
well, unfortunately, we're kind of taught to, you know, and I grew up in the 80s, you know, like and I'm sure this still happens now, but I think a lot of guys grow up being taught to like be a man and not talk about your feelings. And that is not the way it should be, because, you know, it's definitely been a thing where like I've felt on tour, like super down, super depressed, and didn't feel like I could open up to anybody really. And that is tough. And it's something that I've struggled with even like in the past year. I kind of had a lot of revelations. I started going to therapy and I realized that I had this psychiatrist for years that I was going to, but I never really opened up to him. And I feel like a lot of it was because he was a guy, and it was like harder for me to talk to guys about my feelings. Whereas if I had a girlfriend at the time, I felt like I could talk to her or something. I could talk to my mom or my sister or something. But I think it's, for a lot of guys, it's hard to open up to other guys, I think. So,
and it's definitely, especially in Australia, that's a bit of a cultural thing too. Like the attitude of like, she'll be right, mate. You know, like that real dismissive kind of attitude. Hopefully it's shifting a little bit more, but I can imagine it's the same globally with everyone.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty much a worldwide.
Yeah. And so, I mean, obviously you have a great scream. That's very, you know, it's a very guttural scream, but is that part of your therapy for you? Like, is that cathartic in itself?
Absolutely. And I mean, not even the screaming, but the writing the lyrics, and like the lyrics for Darkest Hour have always been just kind of like an outlet for my depression, for my whatever I'm kind of struggling with at that time in my life. So yeah, I mean, I've said this so many times, like being able to get up on stage and like scream about your problems pretty much is like, and have people scream the words right back at you is kind of like, yeah, that was my therapy for so long when I was kind of neglecting that part of my mental health.
Yeah. And for me, I always found it really challenging as like a female when I was a bit younger, had like a lot of repressed anger in me, and it's very hard. I found it hard as a female to know where to channel that. So for me, going to concerts and screaming like was therapy for me, because it was allowed, it was acceptable, it was okay for me to, I mean, I was always, it's not like I was in the midst of it, like I'm still quite introverted. I really wish there was an introverted section at concerts where someone could just stand, like all the quiet people could just stand.
Like it's like a, like the quiet mosh pit, you know, it's
like I really love this band, but I'm also concentrating and deeply focused. And then I feel like, because, you know, I've paid my dues and I've gone to so many concerts, I should be allowed like a section. I feel like there should be like a rite of passage. I used to find that incredibly therapeutic and cathartic for me, because I couldn't express myself with that anger I didn't have a healthy way to do it. I'm lucky, I guess, it never manifested anywhere else other than being able to do it in like a concert environment.
You know, I've heard that from a lot of fans, and I've heard from a lot of people about how going to punk hardcore metal shows specifically, even if you're not like thrown down in the mosh pit or whatever, just being in there and being part of that whole energy, like a lot of people have told me that it's extremely cathartic for them and helps kind of like get away from the monotony of their daily life or whatever's kind of bringing them down at the time. And then,
absolutely.
And then, you know, a lot of times, like, I mean, I've heard from a lot of fans also about, you know, because of the nature of stuff I write about is a lot of time pretty heavy and emotional. I've heard from pretty much countless amount of fans that were like that, so that they could identify with that so much and that helped them. And like, it's kind of like the ultimate compliment that I've ever received is people telling me, hey, I was really struggling. You know, I was depressed. I was suicidal. And listening to your music, is people have told me it's literally saved their lives. And like, it's really heavy and really crazy to hear that, but it's also like,
yeah,
extremely humbling.
It's true. Like I remember listening to the lyrics to Love is a Weapon, and just that, for me, I mean, obviously I've listened to you guys for a long time, but that song really hit a nerve with me. So it, you know, that's, like you said, that there is that ability for music to bridge like that gap. And I you know, it is important to, I guess it's like your journal in a sense, like the lyric writing process. I also think, gosh, that's so intimate. The whole process to me for lyric writing just seems so incredibly intimate. Do you get input from other people, or is that just solely you doing that stuff?
I sometimes, like when we started the band, didn't really know how to write lyrics. I wrote about half the lyrics for like the first demo and EP, and then up to like Mark of the Judas, which is our first full length. Mike wrote a handful of the lyrics on that. And then once we got up to like, and then So Sedated, actually, like I probably only wrote about half of that album too. And then once we got to Sadist Nation, I was pretty much writing everything. So, but it's like I was saying before, it's tough to get criticized on lyrics when you're like writing these heavy emotional topics like that are super, super personal.
I never thought of it from that perspective because I'm like a fan and listener, I guess. But you're right, when you have got this external force commenting and critiquing you, it's like someone coming in and pulling apart your psyche in a sense. No one really likes that.
Absolutely.
I mean, you spoke a little bit like when you come off stage, but what do you do after such a big performance? Do you need time to withdraw and go within?
I do. I have to have at least 5-10 minutes of silence. And it used to be, you know, I would get off stage, I would go if there was a part of the club I could be by myself, I would go there, or I would just go sit in the van and just kind of like decompress for 5 or 10 minutes. Because it's so intense that if I don't do that, if I just kind of like jump off the stage and go right into like hanging out, I would kind of like I was saying before, I would really try to keep the fire going in a sense and just start getting wasted or something. And that was never a healthy road to go down. So it's something like past year or so, I pretty much quit drinking completely, and I started going to therapy. I actually started doing this new kind of therapy called TMS, which is like a magnetic therapy. And since I started doing that, I only did like 2 tours, and that before the pandemic hit. And one, it was the Darkest Hour tour, and then the tour with my other band, The Primals. And so I did those 2 tours where I wasn't drinking or doing drugs or anything like that. And I would, my like kind of replacement for that was sitting in the van and lighting a candle.
Well, that's kind of like, I was about to ask you, do you do like any meditative practices? Because that kind of sounds like that is sort of a meditative practice.
Not like officially, like I've never really learned how to meditate, but that kind of became my way to decompress after a show. I would go sit in the van and light my little scented candle and then just kind of like sit there with my thoughts for like 5-10 minutes. And to be honest, it's way, way better than drinking or smoking weed or whatever else, you know, to try to like rebalance yourself, I guess.
Yeah, we'll definitely dive into that a little bit later on. Just want to ask a light question quickly, just amidst all this. So what's the weirdest thing that's happened to you on stage? Well, not to you, or just like what's the weirdest thing in general that's happened on stage for you guys?
Weirdest thing that's happened on stage? I don't know. You know, we've actually been like getting groped probably because... not something that's happened that many times, but it's something that's happened a handful of times, which is more than you would think. You know, we're not like...
Is that like when people like jump onto the stage and then just
pretty much sexually assaulted, which is kind of crazy. Jesus. Like getting our junk grabbed. That's like something that's happened multiple times, like to each member. Well, not the drummer because they can't get that far, but
they're protected. Exactly. They're in a barrier. Yeah.
But that's definitely like, probably the craziest thing. And it's,
what do you do when that happens? You kind of, that's like such a role reversal.
Like, yeah, I mean, you kind of have to keep going. Like, it's different for men than it is for women, I think. Like, I think women are way more often the victim of sexual assault. So I think that it's harder being a man. Like, the first time it happens, you're almost like, whoa, I'm like David Lee Roth up here or something. And then, like, second time it happens, you're like, I mean, this is just for me personally, and then like the fourth or fifth times it happens, you're just like, what the fuck? Like, what are you doing? Like,
Yeah, what did so like
rude.
I'll be completely honest here, because like obviously being a girl and like enjoying bands, I go very introverted and from a respectful point. Like I was very lucky. I got to go backstage for Nine Inch Nails, and I always just say to everyone, I just stood in the corner and just watched everyone. Like I just didn't know what to do, and I didn't want to be disrespectful, so I just stood in the corner like an idiot being a mute. It's just a strange world. I guess it's a very heightened bubble that you guys sometimes are living in. So,
Certainly,
gosh, all right, tick that question
yeah,
off my
that
list.
was supposed to be the
All
light
right.
question. Sorry.
Yeah, there you go. I guess a lot of people use music as their stress relief, but then when you're in a band, I wonder whether that's got a slightly different context, because is it sometimes too much music saturation? Like, I can't imagine that you necessarily want to go and listen to, like, your iTunes list of or Spotify list. Like, is it sometimes that music is just too much music everywhere?
Definitely, like there are times when I'm on the road where I just need like silence, and that's something that I learned through years of touring. Is like a lot of times, like pretty much every day now when I'm on tour, I'll find some time to go like take a walk and have some silence. And but I also have used music to kind of like, but not like metal at all. You know, like there were, you know, like
No.
I would listen to Sigur Rós or something in my bunk, or and that was always like a really awesome way to kind of like offset the being around crazy intense death metal type stuff all day, you know.
Especially when you do those massive festivals, like I can't imagine sometimes the emotional toll that might take, because they're huge festivals. Like, we don't have them here in Australia, like Mayhem festivals and stuff. We don't, which has always been very upsetting to me. I can just imagine that that would just be exhausting in every sense of the word.
It definitely is. It was, I mean, the first time we did that was in 2004. We did the Ozfest, and that was kind of like a breakout experience for the band. We were on our Sadist Nation record. We were just kind of starting. We're starting to kind of like live off of the band. We were touring full time, 8, 9 months out of the year, and it was a wild experience. Like that was the first time we were playing in front of, you know, 10, 20, 30, up to like 40, 50,000 people at some of these shows. And we were on this rotating slot, and sometimes we were playing at 9:30, 10 in the morning. Like, so it was,
Oh my God, way too
yeah.
early.
So literally like waking up kind of hungover, stumbling on the stage and playing in front of 10,000 people. And, that's definitely a bit of a mind fuck, and took, I think, you
Yeah.
know, when we did that tour, to be honest, I feel like I personally may have taken it for granted a little bit. I think I was kind of in the height of my like being a rebellious punk partier type dude, and you know, was kind of thrown into this system, and I didn't really know how to handle it. And all the guys, like all the lead singers for the bands, were up there like, all right, turn to the motherfucker next to you. If they're not moshing, make them mosh. And I kind of like went
Yeah.
this other direction, and I was like almost making fun of it. And like I would get up there and be like, all right, turn to the person next to you, give them a big hug, and pick up a piece of trash on your way out, you know. And like
I'd much prefer that. I get scared when they're like, all right, open the pit up. I'm like, no opening the pit up. I've got my spot. I've got my position. Please don't come in my zone.
And I think that was kind of like
I guess it.
my weird way of dealing with not knowing what to do, really. Like I was you know, more being a scared kid up there, like not knowing how to handle it. And I think that's how I handled it, you know. But then
Did
by
you
the time we
feel
did
like
Mayhem, like, and more like the big Euro festivals, like I kind of started to realize that it's just a completely different kind of show, and you have to treat it as such. Like there's a barricade with 20 feet of space between the people, and it's more like a performance art or something than, or you know, you have to embrace that kind of performance aspect a little bit more than the couple hundred kids packed in a sweaty venue vibe.
I was going to ask about expectations when you started, like you said, to get bigger and get some momentum, did you personally feel like pressure or expectation to present a certain way, embody a certain persona?
I did.
Such?
And I think that, you know, like that's kind of what I was just talking about. Like I didn't know how to handle it. And I kind of like recoiled and, you know, went the opposite direction. And I would just kind of, it took me a long time to like be comfortable on stage, to be honest, like, because I kind of grew up going to these hardcore shows and just seeing like a dude up there, you know, kind of exposing himself emotionally. And to me, growing up more in the punk hardcore world, it was kind of looked down upon to be up there and kind of like being bravado and putting on a show was kind of thought as like, you know, something that was part of the past. And it, you know, it took me a long time to realize that you can still put on an honest performance, even if you're saying the same shit every night and yelling at people to do a circle pit and stuff. Like that can be, you know, it's not like fake, you know, it's not phony. It's,
yeah, you still have that authenticity that you bring to
it. It took me a long, long time to realize that and to kind of find the balance between like,
did you have
putting on an honest performance and getting people engaged? Because a lot of crowds, if you don't tell them to mosh, they might just stand there or something. And then, you know, that part of like the energy of,
that's like a dream for a girl.
But I think part of, and this yeah. is something that kind of ties in your question too, like you get to a point where you expect crazy mosh pits and you expect stage diving, and when it doesn't happen, you like get down on it. And that was definitely a very real thing for a long time when Darkest Hour would play. If it wasn't, you know, if we played in a place,
I guess it becomes a
yeah
marker.
Exactly. And it, yeah. you know, it becomes something that you always kind of reference every show to. You're like, oh shit, remember that crazy show in DC or New York or Budapest or Berlin or whatever? Like then you go play somewhere, and a lot of places are just more like reserved culturally. Like we played, you know, not to like call out any places, but I'm gonna do that, you know, but we famously, whenever we play some places in Northern Europe, like Belgium and Netherlands and stuff, like we'll have these really kind of reserved crowds. And like for a long time we were like, man, we don't even want to play there because no, people don't go crazy, let's just go to you know, Eastern Europe and blah, blah, blah. And there's nothing wrong with that. You know, people want, and I think as we grew older too, like we realized like, you know, I don't want to be in that sweaty group of people. Like I just took a shower, you know?
And also like I said before, because I am a big guitar dork, I like to actually see them. Like I don't want to be, and I've had plenty of concert injuries and I don't want that anymore. Like I think I said to you the other day, I like a seat and a toilet these days accessible. I guess I also wanted to ask you, what activities help you reset then mentally?
Exercise is something that I've gotten into like in the past year and a half or so, especially like when I quit drinking, I was like, okay, I was like starting to get in better shape. So that was helping had some body image issues before in the past. And that was kind of helping my improve that. It's helping my self-esteem. And like exercising, I've come to realize, is a pretty important part of mental health. And even if it's just getting out. So on tour, getting out and like going for long walks is like huge for me. And even if I can't necessarily like work out every day, just getting out and doing something physical aside from the show is something that really helps a lot.
In terms of your drinking, did you black out often when you were on alcohol?
I did, unfortunately. I was pretty much at the point where I was drinking every day, partying every night, and blacking out sometimes a couple nights a week if I was on tour. And it was really a shitty place to be in. Like when you wake up and you don't know what the hell happened, and we got a European siren over here.
I love it. Adds for a little bit of drama.
Yeah, yeah. So yeah, I mean, it's a terrible feeling to wake up and not know what the hell happened and not know what you did. And I think that would always cause me so much anxiety. Just thinking like, oh shit, did I fuck up, you know, one of my relationships with a band member, or what did I, you know, like,
it's... You're trying to recount what you did and backtrack or retrace your steps.
Yeah, it was definitely a rough spot to be in.
How long did you know that you needed to make a change before you actually put thought into action? Was it some time in the making?
I mean, there had been times throughout my alcoholism that I would, you know, kind of have a bit of a wake up call and be like, all right, I'm going to stop. This is enough. And, you know, I would get up to the point of sometimes of like a week or like 2 weeks. And then I would kind of slowly reintroduce booze back into my life. And it would be a thing where like, I'd be like, all right, I'll just have beer and wine, no liquor. And then like the next day I'm like, I'll have a few more beers and a little more wine. And then the next day it's like, you know, I could have like a shot or two, you know? And so it was always this kind of like slow ramp back up to drinking sometimes 12, 15 drinks a day and night, you know?
Did it make you sick?
I mean, it made me sick in the head. It was a big part of the reason I had anxiety. Like I was kind of wrongly diagnosed, I think, with general anxiety disorder back when I was wrongly diagnosed with being bipolar, and realized that my anxiety was it stemmed from alcohol abuse pretty much, because I would wake up and be super hungover and have the feelings of anxiety that like the world was ending and I was going to die, and not a fun place to be in.
So when you realized that you needed to shift your behavior, did that involve a process of painful self-examination, reflection? Like, did you have to sit with yourself and be like, wow, I fucked up this relationship, I abused this person? Did you go through that process?
Yeah, I mean, it took me a really long time to finally like address it and quit for an extended period of time. And that was only a year and a half ago. So I was, I had, you know, messed up relationships in the past, and that was more due to me being emotionally unavailable than necessarily being drunk. You know, I was never like an abusive guy or anything. I was like neglectful of my relationships, and I would kind of be like, you know, really hard for me to work on myself back then. And yeah, like a year and a half ago, I was single. I was living in my apartment in LA, and we weren't touring very much. And so I had a few months off, and I realized that I was like starting to drink really excessively, like by myself in my apartment, sometimes 15 plus drinks a day, like starting in the morning, drinking beer. And
did anyone know that you were doing that?
No, I was pretty good at hiding it. I mean, I think my friends knew that I drank a lot, but I was always pretty good about kind of hiding it. And I was always the kind of guy where I would drink so much and like still kind of be able to compose myself until I got to the point of blacking out, and then I would slow down. I would see videos of myself sometimes, and it's like, it's pretty hard to see videos of yourself when you're blacked out drunk and you're slurring your speech and you're super slowed down. And that's, you know, that kind of came to a head. And it was around the same time that I decided to start going to therapy and start doing this TMS treatment, which is something that if anybody's like really struggling with extreme depression, I'd absolutely recommend checking out.
Yeah, you mentioned it a bit earlier. So what is, just very basically, what does the, I know you said it was, is it magnets that you said it involved?
Yeah, it's, let me think if I can remember the acronym, maybe transneural magnetic stimulation, something like that. It was something my psychiatrist offered, like so I was going through like a HMO basically, which was paid for by the state of California, because California has has healthcare for people that don't make, poor people in California is like, you make under $100,000 a year or something. So I was accepted into this Medi-Cal program and was able to keep the old insurance that I was going to have to cancel because it was becoming too expensive. My doctor recommended this outside treatment center, and it's like, you know, it's like a fully FDA approved kind of, it's not like, you know, homeopathic wellness kind of thing. Not that there's anything wrong with going that route, but it's, I guess in the 60s or 70s, someone figured out that you can use the same magnets that they use for MRIs to kind of stimulate the, I forget the, like, it's like the, it's your mood center, I think is what he called it. And it's like a part of your brain. And basically you go sit in this chair and I went 5 days a week for like 6 weeks, and for about 20 minutes, they just zap your mood center with this little magnet. And it's just like a tapping kind of thing. And it was, so to do that, in order to do that, the doctor told me that I had to totally quit drinking and totally quit smoking weed or doing any other drugs. So it was really kind of like, it was really a combination of everything that kind of like jumped me out of that really super hard depression that I was in for 6-8 months or something.
You had to commit to it, I guess, 100% for it to work.
Yeah. And it was wild. Like after the first couple treatments, I was already starting to feel just night and day, like how much better I felt. I would walk out of the place and like, you can't really actively feel what's happening, but I just noticed that I was like, you know, I'd walk out and I'd be like, oh, look at the pretty flowers, you know, just like my whole overall demeanor was, yeah, like my, you know, my whole demeanor just kind of changed, and I didn't even really want to drink. You know, I was like, I started exercising, I started losing a bunch of weight, and you know, everything just kind of started feeling right. And it was really super helpful. And, you know, I still to this day can't really say if it was which part of that exactly it was, but I feel like it was a combination of doing the, I was also in therapy. So it's kind of a combination of being in therapy, doing the TMS treatment, quitting drinking, quitting drugs. Yeah. And that really like knocked it out.
Yeah, I think having a lot of things, like approaching mental health from various aspects is super important, because I think it is a culmination of things coming together to assist you. And I guess that's a nice segue. I was going to ask you, if you have a sense of clarity now that you're starting to be a bit healthier, do you think that that would be reflected in any lyrics that you write? Like, do you think that will change the content of what you write about now that you're in a different headspace?
I mean, I still have that kind of, I feel like depression is something that it doesn't necessarily go away like a cold or something. You know, it's for people that have it like I do, it's kind of like something that probably going to remain a constant in your life and on some level, you know, it's just how the level to which you take care of it and keep it at bay, and something you have to work at, something you have to really keep on in the back of your mind.
All right, change of pace. What have you been listening to lately?
I've been listening to a lot of like, I've been getting into like instrumental. I've been listening to a lot of like jazz lately and Ethiopian jazz and stuff like this. I realized that a while ago that it's kind of really hard for me to have to passively listen to music. I'm always kind of like paying attention to it. And I realized that stuff that doesn't have vocals in it and lyrics is way easier for me to kind of have on in the background. So I've been really enjoying like putting on some jazz music at night or something and chilling out, making dinner. Because I think about music a lot. I mean, I work on music most days. So it's nice to like, and the music I work on is metal and rock. So it's nice to like kind of definitely change your brain.
I, as much as I love metal too, yes, I do need to have my pop and my girly music as well in the mix. I was also going to ask you if you could share an embarrassing musical confession with us.
Ah, okay, yes. This one's great. This is one that we I kind of, we remembered kind of recently on one of the last tours, we started playing this deeper cut off the Deliver Us album called Tunguska. I had kind of forgotten about this, but when we were doing the album, we were living in Vancouver, doing it with Devin Townsend. It was a really amazing experience. And a side note, that record was kind of like when I really felt like I discovered my voice finally and stopped like screaming as hard as I could. And that was a pretty memorable time for me as far as like developing my singing ability. But yeah, so we were in Vancouver doing that album, and that was like one of the later songs written. So I had kind of like tapped out of, I was getting near the end of ideas. You know, it's writing metal lyrics can be somewhat limiting sometimes. You know, you could, I guess, but it's harder to just write about like pretty flowers and stuff like that. You know, you have to, you gotta use like all the Asian words, you know, creation, like in that Metallica song, like hesitation. You know, like,
yes.
All the Asian words are really metal, you know? So, you know, when you write like a few albums, you start to kind of like repeat ideas. And I was getting a little tapped out looking for some inspiration. Our old guitarist, Chris Norris, actually gave me the idea for the title of the song, Tunguska. It was from this crazy incident in the around 1900, I think, that wiped out like a huge chunk of the Siberian forest, and nobody kind of knew what it was. So I ended up writing about like, you know, what if that was the end of the world and we're all kind of ghosts or whatever. So Mike Schlabman and I are sitting in this apartment and we're vaporizing weed and talking about the album, and Ghostbusters 2 comes on TV and we're watching the part where the painting kind of comes to life, and the guy in the painting, Vigo, I guess his name, he says this one thing where he goes, "What was will be, what is will be no more." And Mike and I just like turned to each other like, holy shit, oh my God, that's fucking badass. And I was like, dude, we got to steal that. We got to use that. So I slipped that into the lyrics, and that's my embarrassing story. That was my, as far as I can recall, that's definitely the only time I've ever knowingly plagiarized. You know, I'm sure I have accidentally plagiarized. So yeah, that
musical
was
borrowing, cultural appropriation and all that. I think in the name of art, you can do anything.
Exactly. Poetic justice.
That's, you know, exactly right. And then what about an embarrassing artist that you might not really readily admit to everyone that you might listen to?
Embarrassing artist. I mean, I'm not really embarrassed of anything that I listen to. I mean, I try to, you know, listen to everything. And I have a niece and she's obsessed with Billie Eilish. And I was like listening to that recently and thinking like, oh, this is cool. I mean, I'm not a teenager, but I love her voice. And like, I love that she seems like so honest and not phony. And I love that she made this music with her brother in his room and ended up being like the next big pop sensation. So yeah, some people might think that that's embarrassing, but I've always said, like, you know, if whatever music makes you feel anything is good music, you know?
Yeah, I'm going to use that one when people give me a hard time for like Roxette or something embarrassing that comes out of my collection.
Roxette is amazing.
I know. The guitar solo in Fading Like a Flower is one of my favorites. I was like, shut up, everyone. I like that song.
Yeah, that's brilliant. That's brilliant music.
All right. So what is maybe in the pipeline for Darkest Hour?
Well, you know, as you know, everything is kind of up in the air right now. We've kind of started to focus a little bit more on stuff that we can control. You know, this is another thing I've learned in my mental health journey, is way more productive to focus on aspects of your life that you can control over than ones that you can't. So instead of kind of retreating back and just being super sad that we can't play shows, we're trying to go other routes. Like, we, right before the pandemic hit, we started this Patreon thing and it's been going really well, and it's actually been kind of keeping the band afloat financially. And so we've been, you know, focusing more on doing some kind of digital content for that, as well as like physical content. Working on stuff for that, like I'm working on a little lyric video right now that's going to be just exclusive for the Patreons. And then we're also doing stuff like we did our first live stream show. And
I don't know. I don't think there's any concerts that have been played in Australia. What's it like over where you are? Are gigs starting to come back? Or I think maybe there's been a few that I know of or that are coming up that where it's like limited capacity only.
They are. So they're doing that in Germany now where I'm living. I've gone to a couple and it's kind of weird, but it's like,
are these metal gigs that you're going to? Or
yeah, I've gone to a couple metal gigs and it's pretty weird. It's you know, they fill the room up with the German beer tables, like they're like these picnic tables, and they're spaced apart and you can go there with your group, but you have to stay sitting down. So like,
unless you're getting a metal gig.
yeah. So unless you're getting up to go to the bathroom or to get a drink or something, you have to stay in your seat. So you've got like people kind of slamming on the table and like headbanging, sitting down. And it's definitely a little awkward. When I first saw it, I was like, you know, it gave me these mixed emotions. Like I felt excited to be seeing live music again. I also felt like, I felt kind of bad for the band, for the singer, especially being up there like, you know, all right, everybody, you know, let's just jam out. Let's just sit there and
tap our feet.
Yeah, you know, smash your beer glasses on the table. And so it's better than nothing. And if you know, we've got to take this thing step by step. We can't just do what some states are doing, like with this Sturgis bike rally, or you know, places that are opening up way too early and having shows in America, just regular shows, and then, you know, go figure, a bunch of people get COVID. It's like, no shit.
I've got a mean question for you. Well, I think it's a bit mean. Mm-hmm. Are there, because you've played with so many bands, so are there any standout ones that you've played live or toured with?
Yeah. So the first big festival we did, the Ozfest in 2004, that was the first time that we toured with some major bands. And we toured with, and that year it was Black Sabbath, the original four, and I'm pretty sure that was the last time that the original four toured together. It was also Judas Priest and Slayer, and those are the three main headliners. And so like just being able to go see that every day was such a big inspiration. And a couple other tours, doing the At the Gates reunion tour in 2008 was pretty massive for me, because they're such a huge influence on Darkest Hour. We, you know, when we started, Mike and I didn't really know about much modern metal. He grew up on a lot of classic metal, and I grew up more, like I was saying, on 90s Nirvana grunge kind of music. We kind of discovered, you know, the Swedish death metal bands, At the Gates and Flames, and also like Carcass, and just kind of the more modern metal. We discovered that around like 97, 98, and we were like, okay, let's go this direction. You know, let's try this. Let's try making songs like this. And that ended up kind of being a huge part of the Darkest Hour sound. So touring with At the Gates was crazy. We got matching tattoos with Thomas Lindberg. You know, like that was pretty surreal experience. And another huge standout one for me was when we got to tour with this band Cursive, who's like a really great indie rock band. And you know, when I tell people that we toured with them, they're like, whoa, what? Wait, what? That doesn't make sense. Because we were doing, this was back when George W. was running against Kerry, and we took part of this tour. It's called the Plea for Peace tour, and they were, you know, the whole, it was just kind of like a fuck George Bush tour, basically.
Yeah, there are a few of them going around.
Yeah,
a lot of bands did them.
Yeah, so that was like, it was a pretty super, it was a super eclectic bill. And we were the heavy band out, and touring with Cursive was amazing, because there, you know, Tim Cash is a big lyrical inspiration for me. He's one of my favorite lyricists of all time and singers. One of my favorite memories of that tour was I think it was the first night we played with them. Like, we did our thing, got up there and went wild and raged, did our blistering death metal kind of set. And then we get off the stage and Cursive gets up there and Tim goes, "All right, you guys ready for some sensitive shit now?" And it just really cracked me up. That's one of my favorite moments.
Yeah.
There's some big standouts for me.
And I'm always super envious. I'm guessing that you guys now get to like watch on the side of the stage all the time. You know, you get that privilege of being able to sneak up on the side and watch bands from that prime posse.
We did. And it's you know, it can be hard to go back to like seeing regular shows after you've been right up close. You know, like we've done a lot of the European festivals, the big European festivals too. So played with, you know, we've shared not necessarily the same stage, but played the same festivals as so many bands. Like, gotten to see Motorhead a couple times before Lemmy died. And one of the times that I got to see Motorhead, our tour had kind of combined with their tour at the New England Metal and Hardcore Festival. And we were in this like gigantic old theater and the balcony was closed off. And I remember sneaking up there because I had like, you know, the all access pass or whatever. And kind of just like sitting there in the right there in like the middle of the balcony, and I was just by myself, like watching the whole Motorhead show, and it was super
amazing.
Experience. Yeah, it was super cool.
I want to go back a little bit just before we wrap up and talk about your upbringing and your relationships. And did that impact your mental health in any way?
I think so. I mean, I think that, you know, for better or for worse, we're all on some level just like kind of a products of our parents, products of our upbringing. And, you know, I was raised in the 80s. I was raised by a military dad, and my mom was one of 15 kids in a massive Catholic family. So neither one of my parents got much emotional attention growing up. You know, my dad had to call his dad sir, and
wow.
My mom was one of 15 kids, so it's like it's pretty much impossible to have any individual emotional attention. So I mean, their generation was raised a lot differently, and I think that you take that stuff and you end up kind of like, you know, applying it to your own relationships and your family. And so my family grew up we weren't very affectionate. We never really said, "I love you." We never really like hugged each other, you know? So I think that
yeah,
definitely,
mine's the same.
Yeah. So that stuff definitely affects you. But I think, you know, there's also something to be said for being able to break the cycle. And I think that I see, especially now that we're kind of in the information age, and if you can Google how to raise a kid pretty much, you know.
Yeah, get the iPad to do it for you.
Yeah. I mean, it's I think it's way more common to find stronger emotional bonds and just for parents to pay attention to their kids' emotions. And whereas it was for me, it was more like, all right, figure it out.
Yeah. Shut up, get on with it. Children yeah. seen, not heard.
Or you're in trouble.
Yeah, all those fun things. Is there any final words of advice you'd like to give anyone struggling with mental health?
You know, the thing I always tell people that are struggling is, you know, just remember that you're not alone in your struggle. And there's people out there experiencing what you're experiencing. It's not weird. It's nothing to be ashamed of. And really the thing that helped me more than anything is just talking to people, you know, talking to therapists, but not everybody has equal access to therapists, unfortunately. So you can find people that will listen and give you constructive criticism. Like, you know, you can find your friends or family members and just talk it out. Like, that's, you know, that's so important, because when you don't talk it out, it just stays in your head and kind of festers.
One of my questions, my final question, I guess, to you is, I feel like a lot of men, and this is just from my experience, really struggle with taking that first step of speaking out. And I guess, were you afraid to do it? But when you finally did do it, how was it received? Was it better than you thought it might be? Like the reaction from people?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that it can be such a scary thing to tell someone, hey, I've got a problem. And I think that humans are pretty empathetic for the most part. And I feel like if you're talking to the right person, and finding the right person is extremely important, but if you're talking to the right person, they're going to listen and they're going to provide you with some advice, whether it's good advice or bad advice. You know, you can kind of make that call. But yeah, really just getting it out is so huge. It was so huge for me. Just, you know, talking to a therapist, talking to my friends. But yeah, it was definitely hard because, you know, like I was saying before, as, you know, growing up a man, someone who identifies as a man, you're, you know, really taught by society to not do that, to, you know, suck it up and kind of be a man, you know.
Yeah, and not to feel your feminine side of things, like to be emotional, or it's okay to be emotional. You know, I think that's an important.
Yeah, and being emotional is not just a exclusively feminine trait, and that's something that a lot of people think as well. Like, we're all emotional creatures. We all have.
Okay. Yeah. We're allowed to be.
Yeah, exactly. Perfect.
I just wanted to thank you so much for your time. Hopefully you'll start touring again when the world becomes a little bit more sane, and it would be super cool if you came back to Australia for selfish reasons, obviously. But it's been a while since you guys have been here. So hopefully.
It has been way too long. You know, we're so ready to get back out there, believe me. And as soon as it's possible, we're going to be going all over the world.
Yeah.
So doing what we love. And I can't wait.
Yeah, which will be awesome.
But I will. I have to.
I have to wait. So you'll just have to make good music in the meantime.
Yeah, that's the plan.
So thank you, John, so much. I really appreciate it. And we'll catch everyone on another episode. Thanks again for your time.
Thanks so much for having me, Jen. It's great to talk to you.